we are all human, and some of us may be tougher than others or trained to be tougher in certain ways, but we're still human, right? We still have the same needs, and you know, we may deal with them differently or whatever the case may be, but they do exist, right? And that's the hardest part when people are trained in toughness and identify that way. Often what that translates to is denial of one's own needs, which is different, right? I mean, we can still have needs
Yeah.
and we address them if you know, we can have both things at once, right? We can be tough and perseverant and resilient and all that and still acknowledge the needs inside of us, you know, without feeling ashamed that they're there because they're just human.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking, hot air. I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually it could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Welcome back to Change Agents, an Ironclad original, proudly presented by Montana Knife Company. And today, I don't know if it's safe to say this is my favorite topic, but I think it's one of the most important topics of the modern era. And that is mental health. I worry about people who suffer in silence because I believe that we are more similar than we are different. And if you get to a place where you think that you're alone and nobody might understand what you're going through, it can lead you down a very dangerous path. My guest today to help navigate this topic is Dr. Paul Conte. And you've probably heard of his name because he's been on some massive platforms recently. He is a psychiatrist PhD from Stanford University School of Medicine and is the former chief resident at the Harvard Medical School. He is the author of the best-selling book, Trauma, The Invisible Epidemic, which seeks to understand how trauma works and how we can heal from it. Some stats to prep you for the episode. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illnesses, up to 1 in 5 American adults have dealt with a mental health issue in the past year. And according to the Johns Hopkins Institute, 1 in 4 U.S. adults suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder in any given year. More than 8% of Americans have suffered from both a mental health disorder and a substance use disorder in the past year alone. Have you worked much with military members, people in or post-military service?
Not in a direct way. Like a significant part of my training was at the VA, the Palo Alto VA hospital. So there was, I mean, it was an interesting place at the time. It was mostly older vets. There's some World War II, but a lot of Korea and Vietnam vets. And there weren't a lot of people after that. You know, they would kind of come and go. So I saw a lot through that, through the lens of those conflicts and the impact they had on people. That's the only way it was formalized. You know, was any formalized in any way? But I've had people over the year. I mean, certainly if you do this for 25 years, you see it in people in a lot of different ways. I mean, I married a doctor who was she's a combat surgeon and she's in front of enemy lines. We talk about how, my God, she couldn't admit there was any, you know, there was anything other than toughness, you know, in her, and is driving her into the ground. So because like it's just one example that comes to mind, because I think we see similar things across people who are sort of trained for toughness. You know, like there's some parallel to sometimes what you'll see in doctors or, you know, people who have another flavor of like, okay, you have to be tough. I mean, I think the military's the strongest, right? Because it's such a direct message. But I've had people who've done undercover work and that's not acknowledged, and they're coming back into the world. So I've seen it from all, you know, from a lot of perspectives over the years.
You know, toughness truly was the currency. And if you look at the pipeline that I went through, it's 6 months in the initial training pipeline. It's a crucible. And the curriculum is designed to find that low point. They'll physically suppress you to a place where you start having very interesting conversations with yourself.
Right.
How much do I want this?
Right.
How much do I want to do this? Why do I want to do it? And the career is, you know, keep going, never quit. But the jury is kind of back with the results on a lifetime spent being tough and not dealing with those issues. Why do you think they don't talk about that other side of the coin of at some point in time, you have to release the stress valve. Otherwise, you're going to explode.
Right. I think it's just too short term a perspective. I mean, if you think in the modern world, our horizons, so to speak, get shorter and shorter and shorter, right? And you know, even think now, like a different example would be, you think about like businesses, right? And people, what's the bottom line this month? Or what's the bottom line this quarter, right? As opposed to like having some longer term view. And I think like it's just one example of this human tendency, which is to see things in a very, in a myopic way. And while the short term is important, right, we prioritize that too much, like at the expense of the longer term. And I think this idea, maybe how we have in our society, like it's never good to quit. It's never good to stop. Like we have to be tough. We have to keep going on. And look, I remember I was young. I mean, I think about it sometimes. I must have been like 11 or 12 years old or so. And, you know, that time there'd be these like specials, right? It was just regular TV channels. And they get an 8 o'clock special and it's like a big deal, right? And there was one about Mount Everest. And it was about a particular expedition that had gone up the mountain and a lot of people had died, right? And what I learned from that, even at that young age, I get very clearly, I remember it very vividly, but like, it is not true that you should never stop or that you should never quote unquote quit, right? Or that what hurts us, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, right? Like all those things are not true. I mean, the lesson I took away is people who realized, hey, something has changed here, right? This is not, we thought this is harder than we thought it was gonna be. It's more risky. Like those people who saw that and stopped or quit, quote unquote, lived. Right. They know the next day, oh, the weather's better. And they summit the mountain. The people who wouldn't quit, who kept going, died. Right. And it's something like there is a long term view. And I think in intense situations, you can see why the focus is on the short term. Right. Because there's like something that we want to do right now or an ethic we want us to have inside. But I do think we could balance that. I mean, if you know, if you're in the field, right, then I think there are times when you have to keep going. Right. I mean, you have to do like what you're trained. Like that's why you're trained that way. Right. It's very, very daunting and it seems hopeless and you have to go on anyway. Right. Like that's true. But you can have that and have that very strongly reinforced. Right. While also having a perspective that says this isn't talking about your whole life. You're like, this is right now that you have to do this. Right. But then on the other side of that, you can take a broader perspective of self that might say, is this way of living good for me? Is this working well for me? If I'm here, just for example, a thing that's not uncommon that must be familiar to you is the idea of how I'm here because of my duty in some way, right? This strong sense inside of me, have I fulfilled that, right? Because when we do things in part from a sense of duty, then it's very hard to tell when we've done what it is enough to make ourselves feel good about ourselves, you know? Like I didn't like hospital medicine was difficult and long hours and unpredictable, and it felt very much like abuse. You know, your 8 hour a day job is now 12 or 13, and you know, and I think I don't want to do this anymore, you know. But I thought, try to feel guilty about that, right? Because I'm trained as a doctor, I should be in the hospitals, right? And I had to really, through therapy, come to terms with like, hey, you did a lot of that, right? And like, whatever your duty was to do that, like, you've discharged, and now you have to take care of yourself. You know, now for me, there was a shift. You know, I'm 55, but I have young kids. You know, my oldest is going to turn 10 in a couple of weeks, right? So I thought, hey, you know what? There's a higher power to serve here, right? It's not my duty as a physician is second to my duty as a parent, right? And I think, you know, this is why when people are very, very strongly trained in the way that, you know, what you had told me earlier, right? So you have all the training for toughness, right? And for perseverance and resilience, and you can do that in spades, right? But it doesn't prepare you for personal life things that where we have so much less control, you know, and this idea that we are supposed to control everything is what leads us to sometimes have a lot more trouble in our personal life, right? Because like there's not as much control as there is out in our professional lives, right? Especially competent people and what they choose. So it becomes harder. And I think that's why a lot of those people died on Mount Everest and continue to, right? The story is the same. Right. Where they're like, no, we have to go on. I'm trained to go on. This is what I do is go on. And the thought is maybe sometimes, but like they're very, very rare times. Right. They like, you must now go on. Like I would imagine a combat situation. I wrote my first book about my uncle, you know, who was in World War II. And when, you know, when all the officers had been killed, he needed to lead the men out. And like, there was no choice. So it's good. He was trained in, and he had it naturally in him to do all of those things. But when he was on the other side, he thought, I want to go home. I want to live a good life. I want to live a peaceful life, right? So, and even, you know, he had a sixth grade education, my uncle Rango, but he understood when it was time to do what you had to do, there was no alternative, right? Then you do that. And I'm trained to do that. I know how to do that, right? But I'm judicious about when I do that. And he didn't want that anymore. You know, it took too much of a toll on him. So does that, I know I'm talking at you a lot, but does that make sense?
No, it makes sense. And honestly, in your description, you described the internal battle that I went through coming to the decision that I needed to end my marriage of almost 20 years. It was my choice to end it. And I always just speak broadly about it because my ex-wife doesn't have a platform. But I think what's safe to say is that her and I both agree that it was for the right reasons, but it probably should have happened a decade before.
Right.
That never quit attitude will allow you to do things that people will scratch their head and not understand how you did it. But it's a double-edged sword that can keep you in things that you should, you know, unhealthy, toxic relationships or alcohol or substance abuse. Those are things you probably should quit. And I watch a community of people who, again, the only equity is you can never quit. And so regardless of what you're smashing your hand with a hammer, and I'm just going to keep going day after day after day. Well, pretty soon your hand's pulverized and then you're just working your way up your arm. And I don't think that's what that tool is designed for.
Right, because what doesn't kill us? Imagine that metaphor where you're hitting yourself in the hand with a hammer, right? And now it's moving up. You're like, that's really bad for you, right? I mean, it's bad for anything.
It looks good on a fortune cookie. It's great fortune cookie wisdom. I think it fails the crucible of real life.
Right, absolutely. It fails the crucible of real life because what doesn't hurt us then is making us weaker. If I'm trying to get through life in whatever way, and I metaphorically or really have a smashed hand, I'm now at a big disadvantage. What didn't kill me has made me more likely to be killed, right? So we have to stop and think, when do we stop? When do we take care of ourselves? And look, this is not often a problem in a person who doesn't have a lot of distress tolerance, doesn't have a lot of resilience. I mean, I see all the time, given that my work is selected for people who are high achieving in this stage of my career. So I see a lot more of this where what am I seeing? People who are high achieving, they're people with great distress tolerance, right? Think about that, like being on Mount Everest. Nobody is like, are you going to make it to the top or are you risking your life unless you're great at mountain climbing, right? That's why you're on Everest, right? So you have to have perseverance, resilience, distress tolerance. That's exactly the person who's likely not to understand, right? When too much is too much and it's not going to be okay. Right. So it's always the person who has the distress tolerance, you know, the surgeon, you know, who is able to work 36 hour shifts for 7 years in training. Right. The military person who's selected for the highest level of intensity and risk in operations. Right. There's just two examples of like, of course, it's those people there, just like the mountain climbing. Right. Example. So you have people who are built to not see at the margin. Right. To have a default of keep going, keep going, keep going. And then we have to be able to work against our own internal predispositions, right? It's like saying, imagine if like you're going to ask Usain Bolt to run not 100 meters, but to start like he's going to run 100 meters, like he's racing 100 meters, but then you're going to tell him when to stop. So like, you know, he's going to be at the 40 meter mark. You're like, stop at 50, right? Or stop at 46. It's not going to do it, right? I mean, he's running at full steam and full throttle. You know, if you're running like that, you can't just stop on a dime, right? Which is why it's natural when someone's running like that, whether it's, you know, it's in the military, it's mountain climb, whatever it may be, that person's running like that. That's how they're there. They're not just likely to run up. Oh, I should stop now at this point on the mountain, right? Or at this point in my career, right? I should stop and attend to other things. That's precisely the person who's not going to see that. So every good quality has its downside. I mean, everything does, right? So we look at that and say, distress tolerance, perseverance, resilience, internal strength, these are great things, right? But they'll work against us like any other good quality, right? Unless we're aware. And we say, look, where does this stop? Like, you know, this is a great thing I have in me, but I have to manage it. Now it's incumbent upon me to understand it and to have better control of it, or that advantage that I have will hurt me.
Easier said than done, speaking from my own personal experience.
Oftentimes we don't do it until we get hurt, right?
Yeah, until you fall apart.
Right, and then we realize like, I am human, right? And I see a lot of that too, where a person is confronted with their humanity, right? That they do have limits, right? And that's a very big, like what gets called, it's an ego injury, Right? Like if somewhere in your head is that you should always, 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 always keep going, no matter what, that's not true of any human being. When you find that it's not true for you either, it seems very personal. What is wrong with me? Right? I'm a failure compared to who I thought I was. Like those kind of thoughts, right? So it all has to be grounded in we are all human. Right? We have 24 hours in our day. We have so much energy in us. Even the most energetic and robust of us is going to have limits. Right. And like that's okay. So see, we start at everyone has a right to be human. Now within there are going to be those of us who can do more and those of us who can do less. Fine. If we're the people who can do more and have more within us, right, to push forward, we have a greater responsibility to monitor ourselves more carefully, to understand ourselves better. That's the responsibility to self and to others. Right? How are we going to take care of other people that we love? Right, and we want to take care of if we're not taking care of ourselves. I mean, it seems so simple, but it's like the oxygen mask on the airplane, right? The oxygen mask comes down, put yours on first, right? Right. So I was like, that's not because everybody's supposed to be selfish. Because if you don't, then you pass out and you're not going to put it on the kid, right? So like it really is true that we've got to look at ourselves, and often that's the self-enforced blind spot. Like my own humanness and whatever fragility there in me is the one thing I'm not going to look at. Right. And people will say this. I'll see someone who they have a car and they get the car maintenance relatively regularly. Right. They're not just driving the car until it breaks or the wheel falls off. Like, yeah, I take care of my car. Sure, I do. Or they'll say, yeah, I get it maintained because like my family's in, my kids are in it. Right. Okay. That's how you're treating a mechanized thing, but you don't get that treatment. Like, it doesn't matter if you get enough sleep. You just keep going and keep going because you have to and you should. So we'll treat things much, much better than we'll treat ourselves because we understand that things can break. But we often don't understand that we, although not a thing, can break too.
Yeah, as you're feeling it. I actually use that exact same analogy when I'm talking about mental health. Like, it's okay to go crack the hood open on your car before smoke is billowing out from underneath it. Maybe have an expert get in there, peek around a little bit. Maybe they know a little bit more about, like myself, I love driving cars. I couldn't put an engine together if my life depended on it. Why would I not go talk to an expert and say, hey, how's it looking down here?
Right. There's only one reason. And the reason is shame. Right. If you felt it was shameful to look under the, like somehow opening the car hood is so shameful. Right. If you felt that inside, that would be the reason you wouldn't do it. Right. You wouldn't go in there and look. You wouldn't go talk to an expert. It's the shame that we generate within ourselves that keeps us from health so often. That, looking at oneself and one's own humanness and fragility is shameful. It's not shameful to do it for the car, right? But it's
Do you
shameful to
think
do it for the self, and then that's what keeps us away from taking care of ourselves.
I hope you are enjoying season two of Change Agents, which is an Ironclad original. And if you are a fan of the podcast, you know that we are presented by Montana Knife Company, which from where I am sitting right now is a short 2 hour drive, maybe 120 miles due south towards Missoula. I was first exposed to this brand through its founder, Josh Smith. And actually, when I first met him, I wasn't even aware of what Montana Knife Company was. He sat across the table from me. We had a conversation, and I have been a fan ever since. This was a few years ago, and the velocity and trajectory of that company is unbelievable. I directly associate that growth with who Josh is, what he stands for, and what he puts into his product. So, a little bit more about Josh. He's been making knives for 30 years. They're made in the USA. They have a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. They're designed, tested, and they're built by hunters, and MKC's a hunting knife company first and foremost. They sell out their knives sometimes in under 60 seconds. And if you want to see what they have available or what's coming up, surf over to montanaknifecompany.com. They have a new knife drop every Thursday at 7 p.m. Here's what I'm going to say on that. Practice checking out. As ridiculous as that sounds, you need to have your credit card information loaded and practice the checkout process because they go like that. I cannot even count the number of times I have had a knife taken from my cart because somebody was faster to purchase it than I was. People ask me all the time, what's my favorite blade of theirs? I go with the Mini Speed Go. It is my everyday carry knife. I don't use it for knife fighting. I use it for things that I need a knife for, so usually opening boxes. But it is my favorite blade, and if you're a fan of working knives made for working people, I highly suggest that you check out Montana Knife Company. And I'm going to add to that. Let's talk a little bit about the warranty. They had the best warranty program in the industry. No matter if you bought the knife from them directly, or bought the knife from a friend, or it was gifted to you, or if you even found the knife, they're going to honor the warranty for the life of the blade. How awesome is that? Couldn't be more proud to have them as the presenting sponsor of Change Agents. They are a fantastic organization. You think that shame comes from worrying about what other people may think, or thinking that you are alone struggling with what it is that you're struggling with while everybody else is just living their best life?
Sure. So that's what a lot of what goes on in team building situations, right? Is that everyone is trained to think, well, like, we're all here to keep doing this thing that we're doing, right? And we have to keep doing it. Okay. So then no one's really acknowledging, like, they're run down, they're scared. You know, they can't, because they feel like that's not what, we can't do that, right? I have to hang together with the team, right? And then what you'll see sometimes, I see this all the time, where let's say you have a team of them, to make it up, six people, right? And if you ask all six on the outside, they'll say, everyone else, look how everyone else is doing great. It's me who's not. Why? Because everyone else looks great on the surface, right? What they're showing to everyone else. But guess what? This person does too, right? So you could ask all six people, and so then you'll get the answer that everyone's doing okay because they seem to be doing okay, except me, because even though I seem to be doing okay, I know something different inside. Now, if you get all six people talking about it together, they all share the same truth and they strengthen one another. Like, it never happens that in a situation like that, you get all six people together and you share with them that, hey, everyone's kind of struggling in their own ways, and then they all get like weak and lazy and they don't try anymore, or they fall apart. No, they get healthier. Right. And that's why a lot of what happens these days is acknowledging these things, where instead of like, just don't talk about it. Right. Pretend if we shut it down, put it in the back, it'll be OK. As you said earlier, that's not true. Right.
Yeah,
so
it's
now
not okay at all.
We can try and build teams and also acknowledge the humanness. So we can build perseverance and the gumption within us and the strength of self. We can do that without crossing a line where we're pretending, we're buying into something that's kind of a mass delusion that, like, yeah, everyone is like a machine that doesn't break or doesn't run out. That's what we're going to be, right? And it's like, that's not true. And when we acknowledge our humanness as we're striving for strength, we do better.
Where did your journey and desire to practice in the mental health space come from?
Well, I had a career after college. You know, I had a business career. I worked for a consulting firm. And there was a lot that I liked about that. There was a lot that I liked. There are things I didn't, you know, I wanted more direct contact with people. And I wanted to just know more about how humans work. You know, I didn't know anything. Like, I don't know anything about cars and I'd like to, but not enough that I'm going to go do that, apparently. But I didn't know about how people function, and I did want to understand more. So I had all this inside of me, but I felt like I couldn't go do it. Like, I was like 24, but where was it? My mid-20s. And to go change careers, I thought, was I have to go back to college and take a year of science. I didn't have any science. So I'm gonna leave a job that's a pretty good job. I'm gonna pay for a year, right, of school again, and then I won't really make a good salary for like another 9 years, right? And it seemed like, oh, how could I do that? Like, I didn't understand. Of course I could do that. Like, I was healthy and like, I had the wherewithal in me to do it, right? It wasn't that I couldn't do it, it was that I was so afraid and ashamed. Oh, I'm gonna change career paths. What will people think? And sure enough, when I did leave, people did say that, like, oh my gosh, you must be crazy, right? You're not going to make any money for 10 years, right? But like, it's okay, right? I'm still here, right? I survived without making much money for 10 years, right? But I didn't understand that. And it was the environment I was living in where people were like, oh my God, how could you do that, right? But here's the truth of it. Once I was doing it and I was leaving, it wasn't that I was leaving for medical school. It was that I was leaving to do something I really wanted to do against some of this imposed shame. That people started to ask me, how are you doing that? I want to do that too. Yeah. I want another job. I want another career. I want to work less. So I was right about how the environment reacted to me. What I didn't understand at the time is that we were all acting in a way that was false, right? Like, this is the greatest thing to do, and we have to keep doing it, and it's successful, right? And we're being successful, and we're working hard. Like, we can't stop it when many, many, many of us wanted to stop it. Like, so this was all swirling around inside of me. And then after the loss of my brother to suicide, that you know, it was, it just brought everything to a head for me. And that's when I realized, hey, it's not that you're so old, you're 20 something and you can't do anything now. It's that you're only 20 something. Like, just go do that thing you want to do, right? Go work at that. Don't think, oh, I'm not going to make a good income for 10 years. Think, I'm going to choose what I do tomorrow. And that's got to make tomorrow okay, whether I'm making income or not, right? And it's that it led me to reassess everything from a very different perspective. It brought it all to a head and gave me the internal clarity to see what was true that I couldn't see before that loss.
I'm very sorry to hear about your brother. I wasn't aware of that. I come from a community of people where I don't want to say it's an epidemic of suicide because it's not, but I will say that it is statistically above the norm in many other communities, but probably similar to first responder. And it's a topic that I have talked about with many of previous people that I served with, and I've yet to be able to come to any level of understanding why it is so much higher in the community of people that I used to work with, unless it has something to do with the isolation or, like you mentioned, the shame or the unwillingness of wanting to share or reach out because of how people may view it. And it's led me to deeper questions along the way, and I'd be curious your thoughts on this. You know, a lot of times when people look at veteran suicide, they only look at what happened in service, things they might have been exposed to in the service.
Right.
And what I didn't realize until recently in having conversations with people that I used to work with, because we never used to sit around and be like, oh, hey, tell me about your childhood.
Right.
You know, like, oh, you know, we never talked about what happened before the military.
Right.
And so somebody who kills themselves after they serve in the military, of course, horrible loss of life, and it has just such profound impact on the family. But I wonder if people, what I've noticed, and I'd be curious your thoughts on this, I have actually found that a large percentage of people that I used to work with actually came from traumatic backgrounds and upbringings. And I'm curious if the job was more enticing to them because of that, because they could do something with that trauma, or was a way for them to not pass it along. And then you still have to deal with it at the end, right? So there's this bridge of in between where you had this occupation. You're still left with the before trauma and then the after.
Right.
I don't know. It, to me, and again, I'm kind of just thinking in real time, but it, to me, the veteran suicide issue is much more, it's deeper than just what happened in service. And that seems to be what people are focusing on. I'm just curious your thoughts. If to people, would you ever see a connection from somebody who comes from a traumatic background looking for a job or wanting to be more enticed by a job in that special operations community because of
sure.
what they do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Yes. And I'll say, I think, when it comes to mental health, the basic concepts are almost always simple. The devil's in the details, right? It's the part of really understanding it that's complex. But usually, if we look for what's the simple premise that's telling us what to anchor ourselves to, and I think what you're describing links to two factors. And I think this is true of anything that really, really pushes a person. Right. So during the military, special forces really pushing a person, right? But same in many ways is true. So people who go into healthcare, right? You know, if someone's gonna go to medical school understands they're pushing themselves, right? There's a selection for people. Same thing with mountain climbers, same thing in many ways with first responders. I mean, you know, there are jobs that pay the same amount of money and don't involve showing up on the scene when someone's been shot, right? So why Yep. show up on the scene when someone has been shot? Why do the things that we're talking about? There's a pushing of self. Someone says, I want to help people. I want to protect people, right? And I see that in order to do that in the way maybe I want to do it, you have to really push yourself, right? So now there's an alliance between I want to do good in the world and I'm going to push myself, right? And a lot of the reasons people push themselves is to try and feel good enough, right? The suicide rates in physicians are higher too, for example, because mm-hmm. we're talking about the same characteristics in people across these disciplines, right? Which is there's something going on inside of me. And I mean, it's not always this, but it's predisposed. It selects for people who want to overcome something. I'll feel good enough when I have that medical degree. I'll feel good enough when I've been able to save X number of people, so many people when I go out in the ambulance. Right, to see them. I'll feel good enough when I protected people by, you know, doing some dangerous military exercise, right? Like it makes sense, right? But there's something to prove to the self as well. which not always, but very often goes back to childhood trauma. So when you say these things, my brain goes, of course, right? Because trauma early on in life affects us the most, right? So no one's joining the military before age 15, right? So right, 18, that's when yeah, most of the trauma yeah. is occurring. That's setting the stage for what happens afterward. So if you look at why is this person having troubles, right? Or why is it may this person have trouble, right? Whether, again, I'm just making the parallel of like extreme sports, military, medicine, or in any of these situations, you know, you have to go look at the selection bias for people that have been through some childhood trauma in those formative years, single digit years up until mid-teens, right? That makes that person want to go out and prove something to themselves. And that person's going to push themselves farther, right? They're going to be able to achieve a lot, but they're also much more likely to not know, like, when should I feel good enough and when should I feel ashamed, right? And that's why you see people who say, want to make money to protect other people. Mm-hmm. And now they've made vast amounts of money and doesn't feel good like enough, right? Because if you don't go back and look at yourself to, you know, enough is never enough. Right. Because you don't go back to what the original problem. If a person can identify, you know, my issue has been, for example, lack of resources when I was growing up and I wanted to earn money to protect people. It was just one example. That person's got to go look at where that came from and how they've changed things for other people. Otherwise, it's stuffed in the background. Too much is never enough. Person has vast amounts of money, loses a little bit of it and feels like a failure. Right. So it's a selection bias. And then also the training systems, as we just talked about, train us to shove down things. Nobody wants to hear that, right? Nobody wants to hear the doctor or the special forces person, right? Say like, hey, I'm feeling really sad and down or hurt. Like, it was hard what I saw. Like, people just keep, put your head down and keep doing your job. Like, that's precisely what gets us into trouble.
Yeah, and then you lose that job. I mean, there are a few instances that I know of from the SEAL community where people took their life while they were active, but the vast majority are shortly after.
Yes.
And it seems, you know, they lose that tool, that mechanism for whatever it was, the ability to do good, the ability to turn their anger towards what they would perceive right. as the same type of trauma that they were receiving. They lose it. They lose the community. Oftentimes they isolate. If I'm being totally honest, there's oftentimes, you know, substance abuse issues associated with that, most commonly alcohol. And it's within a few years of them getting out, they either drink themselves to death or more often than not, they make a poor decision about taking their life under the influence of alcohol. And it's just, it has repeated itself so many times.
Right.
And I don't know if you can, I don't know if there's a solution to the problem, but I think that focusing only on what happened in the military is maybe half of the issue. I think we have to start looking at what brings people or what causes them to want to do that job in the first place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That other part of it can't be less than half. Right? Because it's so important that the sense of self that we form, you know, in those formative years, what our perceived weaknesses are, how we're trying to overcome them. I mean, it's so important. The traumas that we carry with us, things that trigger shame, things that trigger, I'm not good enough. Right? So that has to be at least half of the story. You know, even though there may be a lot of tribulation and trauma while in the military, it can't be that the stuff that came before it is even less than half. I mean, it just sets the stage for all the other things that come inside of us. And there are ways to prevent. I mean, we can't prevent every suicide, but could we prevent a lot of them? My thought about that is, how can the answer not be yes, right? And think about some of what you're saying is, so the person leaves the military and then they don't have that team, the group of people, the sense of self, they're doing something good. Absolutely, all of that is true. Of course, all that is true. And also part of the problem is just that they have time, right? This is the same reason it maps to, like, when people have panic attacks, so many times a person will say, you know, I can't believe it, or I'm surprised. Then they say something that's not surprising when you know, which is they didn't have the panic attack when they were really stressed about something. They didn't have the panic attack during the workday. They didn't have the panic attack while they were juggling those seven things while they were in the risky situation, right? They have it when they sit down at the end of the day, like, oh, I can finally take a deep breath. Sure, because there's, you think how simple it is. There's space in the brain for it. You're juggling.
And the tsunami comes.
Right. It's, or like, you know, nature doesn't like a vacuum. So if now there's a vacuum in your head, because you're not thinking of eight things at once, right? And now you just have that peace inside. it's not good if there are difficult things waiting to run into the piece. That's what causes the panic attack, or that's part of why it's very, very predictable that after people leave the military, all the things that you said and this other huge factor of there's just time and space in here for all the things that have been pushed out of consciousness to come back in, and just a rational understanding of what happens in people, right? And providing real support. You know, it's why like peer support, right? When someone in the profession, there's someone who's gone through it, tells that person they don't have to be ashamed, it's way, way, way more powerful, right? When I can talk to a physician about, you know, you don't have to be ashamed because you know, you saw some awful things and you had difficult things in childhood and you developed an alcohol problem, but you want to get over this and go back to your job, right? Or you developed an alcohol problem and you can't go back to your job. And we're trying to, how do you have a good life anyway? Like, whatever it may be, we have to start with letting that person not feel ashamed, right? What you're doing is hard. I've been through my own troubles. I understand where you've been and you can relate to me and me to you. And I get it. And I've had my own issues, right? I mean, people respond so strongly to that because that's the best way to relieve shame. I mean, what if we did that? We realize every single person coming out of the special forces is at dramatically elevated risk. And I don't know all the numbers, but the risk is dramatically elevated. That much we know. Yeah. So what if we
none of them are good?
That?
Yeah. Yeah, none of the numbers are good. I don't know how them precisely either, but they're a hockey stick in comparison.
Right. So think about it. We don't need to have, right? Because we know the only thing we need to know. The risk is way too high. So we can respond to that and say we can manage this risk. We can put like peer support systems, you know, treaters, people to evaluate that don't make people ashamed to go in and see you. It's like a network of people. Like, you see how this could be so much better. And you make connection because, you know, when people are in team settings, they do what's called an affiliative defense, right? Which isn't just, I feel more safe because you're there and I know that you're competent and this and that. It's that, but it's more than that. I just feel safer because I'm part of something, right? And I feel also more validated that I'm part. If that something goes away, now I'm not part of a team anymore. I don't have what's called the affiliative defense. Now I'm alone with the pain or the stressors where I just felt safer just because I was part of that team, even if no one is around me at the moment, right? So we need to maintain some of that team setting. Like why can't there be teams of people supporting one another, people who are more senior, been through how hard it is to come out and reintegrate. Why can't we still have that, you know, a team kind of setting? And maybe there's professionals and personal support people and peers. Why can't we have it when people come out? So we say, hey, that's obvious, right? There's something really important you're losing, which is how busy things have been up in here and that you're part of a team. Let's address both of those things. You know, now we start going a long way towards prevention just simply by doing that, you know? It's not that complicated. Yeah. We just often don't do it. We don't step back and we look at the systems and say, where are the risks in these systems? How do we change them? And when we do, a lot of times they're clear answers on how to make things better.
I hadn't thought about the additional time that you have. Like you said, the panic attack doesn't occur in the moment because you're so task saturated, just plugging your fingers in the dam, metaphorically.
Right.
And then you sit back and, you know, on a lounge chair, and then this tsunami of all the things overwhelm you. Yeah, and unfortunately, it seems to be within, I'd say, and this is anecdotally, but about 1 to 3 years of separation from service is when that time, it really starts to rise to that higher risk category.
Well, probably I'm gonna think the risk and the potential for harm starts almost immediately, right? It's just that by the time it's rising, you know, you're seeing in the 1 to 3 year range, the consequences of things that were developed in that first year and then progressed in the 1 to 3 year range. You know, there are things where prevention involves rapid access. Like this is the kind of thing where clearly if we wanted effective preventive medicines, we would be talking to people about this well before they leave the military. And we'd be talking about when does the risk come at moment one. I mean, when I've worked with people who are going through very, very difficult things, like it's an example recently of someone who went through the protracted death of a loved one, right? And there was a lot of grief and a lot of hard feelings in the context of a lot of pulling for attention, right? All the time, there are things to do and go see the person, try and work things out. And this was so stressful for the person involved. Then the loved one passes away, right? And there's a sense of relief because we knew the person was terminally ill. They're like, okay, now this person can like be okay and get some rest. No, that's the point when I become more worried. Now that person is going to sit, you know, metaphorically sit down on the couch and exhale. And then everything rushing through, all that pain and fear and distress is going to come to them. So, you know, we tend to be least worried when we should be most worried. And I would be telling people that the extra risk, like we can look at the numbers and say, you are at higher risk for really difficult things happening in life, right? Like addiction, right? For example, like depression, right? And things that can end life, like suicide, right? That's the truth. The numbers tell us that. So let's start preventing now, because the risk to you starts clicking away moment one when you go. So let's decrease that risk now, because one, you don't have to be one of those statistics. And actually, if we do this enough, we can change what those statistics are.
Yeah, I agree with you. I can't speak to, I've been out of the military for 10 years, so I can't speak to any changes that have occurred since that time. But let's just say the exit mechanism that I had was the opposite of what you described.
They're like, right.
Bon voyage, pick up your DD-214 on the way out, and best of luck.
Yeah, right. And I think we have an obligation when people do things that serve the rest of us. And really, anyone who's helping someone else is serving other people. Like, think about the paramedic, the EMT, could make as much money without putting the person's physical and mental health at risk. Right? There's someone who's doing something that takes care of the rest of us, because you or I or anybody else might need an EMT in 2 minutes. Right?
Yep.
So we have an obligation to take care of people like that in society, but we don't. We just don't do it. And if you think here, how are we not taking better care of people who are literally putting their lives at risk for us, right? Both when the lives are actually on the line in the moment, and then all the things that are inside of people that put them at risk after the fact. Like, how do we not do a better job for people that are protecting, you know, our literally our safety? Like, I find that, I'm not trying to be critical of like even specifically the military or this or that. I think it's us as a society that it's egregious. The same way, you know, we didn't attend to the health of nurses after the pandemic. It was like, well, gosh, that was really awful. Now go back to work as usual. They were overwhelmed before, you know, the years of horror, right, that went on. But, you know, it's easy to say, oh, back to business as usual. Just like, you know, okay, bye-bye. You're on your way out now and good luck. I mean, we have an obligation as a society to take care of people more than this. I mean, I think it is shameful that it is shameful. Sometimes shame is there for a reason, right? And I think as a society that we wouldn't invest more, it makes just no sense to me. It's that short-term view again, right? And it's a short-term view infused with just a reflexive selfishness, right? As a society, our priorities are not in a great place, and we don't take care of people who take care of us the way we should.
Yeah, I would say most people, regardless of taking care of others, I think are struggling to take care of themselves. I'm curious along that vein as well, what would you say your broad or baseline definition of good mental health is?
Yeah. And by the way, so I went to add one thing in. You said people who are taking care of others, right, and then taking care of themselves. The people who are taking care of others are less likely to take care of themselves. That's part of the selection. I mean, it's part of why they're taking care of others. And not that everyone has a blind spot around self-care, but of course you see that, right? That's why people can be getting worse. They kind of know they're getting depressed. They know they're developing a substance issue. They don't tell anyone, right? They're much better at taking care of others, and then they're rationalizing about themselves until they're in too much trouble. So yes, the person taking care of others is the most likely to shortchange the taking care of self. And I think, you know, good mental health looks like curiosity about ourselves, inquiring about ourselves. Like a lot of what I've tried to do recently is talk about this in broader perspectives of not looking at mental health as, oh, like it's a problem. Right? Like we all have mental health, right? Like we're all thinking, right? We're all feeling. So what if we look at mental health in a way that's very different from how modern medicine has looked at mental health, which I think is wildly dumbed down and inefficient and ineffective? What is it? Look, we all have mental health, right? Let's try and understand what that means and know what the pitfalls are potentially and really look right at them and talk about things that we can do. So what are the pitfalls? People don't get help because they feel ashamed of needing help. We should talk to everyone about this, right? People who have more distress tolerance and ability to persevere are more likely to push themselves too far. let's talk about that too, right? Childhood things that we may think we've overcome, right? We've overcome because we're checking the box that makes us think we've overcome it. That's not how we overcome it, right? So think about these basic principles, right? The role of shame in us hiding from ourselves, and then we start this downward spiral. What about even having curiosity about, like, what's going on inside of me? You know, when things are quiet, if I'm in the shower, I'm in the car and no one's there, you know, there's the radio's not on, what do I say to myself inside? Right? What's my narrative? What do I think about myself? Like, we hide these things from ourselves. And I think the things I'm saying now are so basic that I believe this, that we should be teaching age appropriate, of course, aspects of this in elementary school. Yeah. But we don't. Right. I became very upset, and this is really true, when I was a second year psychiatry resident. So I finished medical school. I'm a doctor, and I'm in my second year of training. So I've gone through a lot of the most intense in the hospital. I'm really learning something about psychiatry. And I kept seeing, oh my God, I'm learning things now, 2 years after graduating from medical school, that I and everyone else should have started learning in elementary school. But what's going on inside of us? And how we fail ourselves over time? Even the idea of, like, bullies. We talk about people bullying people, but we don't talk about what's going on inside the person who's bullying, right? We don't talk to the bully about what makes somebody want to thump somebody just because they're smaller than them, right? Person feels less than and feels hurt by something. What is that? Right? Can we look at the whole system, right? And then say, it's not like we're saying the bullying is okay. We're not saying that, right? But we want the person being bullied to understand this isn't about you, except that it's hurting you, right? Is that person needs to hurt somebody, right? So that person has their own issues, and like, we need to go look at those and attend to those issues, so that bully on the playground doesn't become the bully, you know, out in the world in ways that can be much, much worse, right? The thief, you know, the person who's really hurting people in organized ways. Let's look at this when the person is a child, right? They can have a better life. It's safer for everyone else. So we help the bullied person see that it's not them, it's a problem in the other. So we're helping them work against shame. And it's natural, if someone bullies you, you feel less than and weird. Let's talk about what that is. We protect the bully. Then let's go look at what's going on in the bully. We don't necessarily do these things because we're not educating ourselves, right? If we don't educate ourselves, we can't educate the kids, right? Then we have a situation where that same bully, when the person was 12 years old, is the same bully at 72. You know, has a by and large a miserable life, bullying people around them, and it's been harmful to other people, and it didn't have to be that way. So we need to start understanding the basic premises of curiosity about ourselves, what's going on inside of us when we're younger. And so I'm trying to bring that message now. Like, let's all understand that now, right? Because that'll help us take care of ourselves, and it'll help us be better for the people that we're taking care of, people that are younger than us, whether it's someone coming out of the military, you can help now. Or it's a child, right? There's so much we can do for others when we understand better.
Ladies and gentlemen, today's episode is also brought to you by Mountain Tough. It's a unique functional fitness program that is, of course, supported by hunters and SEALs and Rangers and those from the special operations community. But that is not my favorite part of the Mountain Tough system or program. Although it was developed with insights from the backcountry hunter and veteran special operations community, there is an emphasis on more than just physical strength, which I believe to be essential. It is also about building an unbreakable mind. It is easy to build muscles from the neck down. It is far more difficult to build muscles from the neck up and the resilience between your ears. The Mountain Tough app provides the best functional fitness program directly to your phone, tablet, TV, or a web browser. So you really don't have an excuse to say, oh, I didn't know what I could be doing or should be doing, whether it's a program or inspiration or insight. It's all right there at the touch of your fingers. Some of you might be saying, well, I'm not a ex-special operations personnel. I'm also not a backcountry hunter. That's okay. For those of you who might not start out as an elite athlete, but you want to improve wherever you may be, Mountain Tough is determined to push everybody's limits. And they're going to meet you where you are with thoughtful programming, helping you achieve elite status through progressive fitness, focusing on longevity, injury prevention, and holistic development. It's a story arc from wherever you are, getting as close to elite as could possibly be. So what are you waiting for? You can join the global Mountain Tough community right now. A community of people transforming their lives, bodies, and minds. Download the Mountain Tough app today and start training to always be ready. for whatever it is you're trying to be ready for the backcountry, for the mission, or just life's unexpected challenges. Because when it comes to being prepared, there's no excuse to not start now. You can use the code CHANGE, which I'm looking at all capital letters, one word, at mountaintough.com on the monthly plan to get your first month absolutely free after your 14-day free trial. That's 6 weeks free to dive in, test the waters, the programming, and make sure it's actually for you. What are you waiting for? You can change your life today, be ready for the mountains, the mission, and just life in general. Ladies and gentlemen, Four Branches Bourbon is the only spirits company founded by veterans from the Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force. These veterans collaborated with a Bourbon Hall of Fame master distiller and legend to help them make their smooth but complex blend of four-grain and 96-proof bourbon, blended and bottled in Bardstown, Kentucky. It is often said that bourbon without a story is just brown water, and this bourbon has a story with over 100 combined years of military service around the world. At Four Branches, they are not just crafting some of the finest bourbon, but they are reshaping the drinking narrative. Their motto, drink honorably, embodies their ethos of sipping to remember, not to forget. And as veterans, we get to come home while others did not. So if you're going to drink, please drink honorably. And don't drink to forget, but let's sip to remember. And if you are going to sip and you like bourbon, this has a very interesting taste. Not that I'm a bourbon connoisseur or expert, but smoother than I thought it would be. I've had some bourbons that about ripped my face off. This was the exact opposite. So please enjoy honorably. If you want to learn more about Four Branches, please check out their story at fourbranches.com and pick up a bottle of their fine bourbon today using the code IRONCLAD10. That is all one word, iron, normal spelling, C-L-A-D, 10. You're going to get 10% off. For people listening who have either not really thought much about their mental health or perhaps recognize they're on the precipice of something trending in a downward direction, do you have an approach for people to check back in with themselves in a little bit more of an objective way? Like I don't want to say a mantra or, you know, however you would maybe clinically describe it, but just a way to check back in and be more aware of where you are in your mental health journey.
Yeah. What we're trying to do there is be able to observe ourselves, right? So instead of like, I am miserable, I am scared, it's like, I am scared and I see that I'm scared. But the part of me that sees that I'm scared is not so scared that it can't see rationally, right? So I can see that I'm scared, and then the part that's observing that, or I'm angry or whatever it may be, can look at that instead of saying, oh, I'm angry and I'm ashamed of being angry. I'm angry and why am I angry? And why am I ashamed of that? Because that's how we start to problem solve, because we can observe ourselves. And the series of four podcasts on the Huberman Lab in September that I did really kind of talk about this, like what's going on inside of us. And then it speaks to how do we try and stop and take stock of ourselves and look at ourselves and be able to assess ourselves, even if it's just, oh, I write a little bit then. I talk to a friend then. I go for a walk, and instead of running the same things over in my head, I'm looking around me and I'm letting myself think. I mean, there's some simple ways we can do that. Sometimes we need more than simple ways, but I try to talk about that in that format so it kind of leads people through. So that's what I would reference, I think, for another resource.
It was an excellent four-segment series. Fantastic podcast series, by the way. Yeah, we have nowhere near enough time to try to unpack those things. I would absolutely point people at those as well and to chip away at them as they could. From your clinical approach or what you've seen in your experience, would you say, and let's just talk maybe just the U.S., would you say mental health is on the rise or decline?
Oh my goodness, it's on the decline. I can't imagine that it's anything different. There's so many data points that tell us that the increasing distress in people, the increase in isolation, right? Not just one person isolated from all others, but the isolation of like how we believe, no matter what someone thinks or believes, whether it's one point of view amongst a bunch of rational points of view, or it's a point of view that's entirely false. Like if I want to think that 1 + 1 = 3, I'll bet I can find a whole group of people who think that too. And now I don't have to go look at that anymore, right? Then I just think 1 + 1 = 3. And if you start telling me it's 2, well, then what's wrong with you? Like, I can't hear, right? I can't hear new perspectives. Yeah. And then we get much more defensive. So much of this has happened. I mean, the rise of interconnectedness in social media does help, right? It helps through venues like this, where we're trying to get good information out to people. And there are a lot of other venues it helps. But there are a lot of ways in which it's done a lot of harm. And we have something that's powerful and not adequately understood and controlled that could do good and harm. The harm will outweigh the good unless we take control of it and make the good outweigh the harm. So I think our ways of communicating, the political situation, the pandemic, the wars, that things have gotten worse, and we just have minimal resources, absolutely minimal resources. You think about the things we spend money on. We spend millions of dollars because there's somebody's a political argument with someone else, and you know, now there's a bunch of things going on to fact find something everybody knew the answer to anyway. Just one example, right? We spend money on so many things, but we're not doing things like looking at the bridges, right, that are in disrepair. I mean, if there are giant barges going underneath bridges and there are pylons on both sides where if the barge hits the bridge is going to fall over. The answer to that proposition is a bridge is going to be hit and fall over at some point. We know that. So why don't we go look at that? Why didn't we look and say, hey, that bridge in Baltimore is at risk? Or now we see other bridges are at risk. I see it in the news now. Are we going to do anything about it? Or is it easy to say, well, it's not happening now, right? Just like it's easy to say, congratulations for your military service. Good luck. Instead of saying, that's not right. Right? What do we have that's more important to put resources in? Right? Why don't we go look at every bridge, the safety of every road, the health of everyone who helps take care of us? These will cost billions of dollars. What are we wasting billions of dollars on? We got things more important than that? Not much.
Not that this is possible, but what do you think the impact on mental health would be if social media platforms got shut off?
I mean, it's like all of them or in a selective way?
Well, it was about a month ago. I think Facebook was shut off for about, 4 hours. And I think Instagram was associated with it. And people were losing their minds. And for me, I was like, oh, this is great. I don't have to be on my phone.
Right.
I'm just curious what you think. I don't think the human species is capable of evolving at the velocity that these platforms are and the interconnectivity that you talked about. We have access to untapped information. Largely, it's like an 80-20 anecdotally negative to positive. It's this compare and contrast. Look at me, look at me, look at me. I'm wondering, if it was all to shut off, I mean, obviously we'd have to deal with the chaos and people thinking their life was upended. I tend to think, though, that the net of it would be quite positive.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. Why? Because I think now the net of it being there is quite negative, even though there's so many good things, right? But because it's uncontrolled and then it's easier to destroy than create. This is a human story. Right? It takes a long time to build a building. They knock it down very, very quickly. So. It's much easier then to use any powerful tool to destroy, to be destructive, than it is to create. And that is true of social media too. So yes, I think it would be true. If we shut it all off, it would be net positive. But that's, again, shame on us as a society for it being that way to start with, right? And think about the short-term view of things where we're saying that people are looking too much at this week's or this month's, you know, results of health for a company, or I'm surviving now. And that's got to be good. I'll survive next month instead of thinking I can't survive this for another year. And so this has been a growing problem. The inability to defer gratification, project into the future, more of like I want or need something now. And so think about what you said. Facebook gets shut off for a day. People are like, don't know what to do. Hey, that is way too much need for immediate gratification. I mean, think about how that speaks to what we're talking about. And we need to like, whoa, stop. You know, let's get back to basic principles of how we're living our lives and how we're looking to feel good. Because if you're feeling good because of things that are happening in the moment, right? In the moment, then you're not thinking ahead. And it's interesting. So people then often don't feel good because something is turned off. We see this when there's an outage of one of the news sources or this or that. But you just described what comes into us by and large, like from news sources, right? It's like 80-20 or more negative. So now I'm upset that I don't have a free flow of the thing that's hurting me. I want a free flow of it because it's distracting me. This is why people talk about addiction, you know, internet addiction or shit. And it's not something special. Like the thing not to do and what medicine wants to do is that's something new and special. No, there's addictive machinery inside of us that prioritizes the short term over the long term. Like, why does the person who's an alcoholic and knows that alcohol is hurting and killing them, drink, right? Because it will soothe when they put the bottle up to them. It'll soothe in the short term. They know that, but don't have a better solution. So you look at what's in the short term at the expense of the long term. Isn't that what we're talking about? I want my 80-20 negative news. I'm mad I don't have it, even though it's hurting me. I mean, we have the insight into what's going on inside of us, then we can handle things much, 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 much better, including, and maybe most importantly, with social media, because I don't think we understand how much time this short-term view, recruiting addictive machinery, losing the long-term perspective, we don't understand how much it hurts us. But I think when a barge hits a bridge and it falls down and we realize, oh, that would have been preventable, but it would have taken a lot of time, attention, prioritization, money, but we didn't do it. Then we think, hey, what's going on with us? Do we need to make a full stop and look at how we're living as a society, how we're projecting forward? Because we're getting worse and worse at it. Even people choosing a leader for X number of years. I mean, isn't it a danger that, say, in the presidential race, we choose a leader who's going to lead for 4 years, but most people's view of their lives is now pushed down, not anywhere near 4 years. Like, just fundamentally, how do you make a good decision 4 years in the future when you can't see more than this year, right? So it's clearly bad. I think there's no opinion. I mean, anyone can have an opinion about anything, but how could it be okay to not be able to think as far ahead as you're making decisions? Right? So I think it's very, very clear we have to change things. We have already made great peril for ourselves, and people get hurt and killed all the time because of the peril that I'm talking about. Most recently, people driving over a bridge or working on a bridge could kill. It's horrifying and predictable and avoidable. And it's a symptom of a societal sickness that I think we can change, where we go back to the basic principles of how are we taking care of ourselves, including our mental health? Am I curious about what's going on inside of me? Right? What role might what I'm doing now, how might it be related to things that are in my head from when I'm a kid? If I'm saying that thing in my head doesn't matter because I was a kid, why the hell is it still in my head when I'm an adult? Right? So, we start being more honest with ourselves, honesty and curiosity, and we avoid a lot of problems, whether it's the veteran who starts drinking because they're difficult thoughts and memories inside and there's not a team feeling to deal with it and there's too much time for it, then we'll do that better. Also from the individual person through to, maybe we should take care of the bridges better, because guess what happens if we don't do anything? Eventually another barge runs into a bridge and knocks it over. Then we go, until the next one happens. I mean, it's not acceptable, and we can change it.
In the decades you've been practicing, how much has the approach to mental health shifted, or has it largely stayed the same?
Oh, it's gotten very clearly worse. Much, much more focus on the short term. But even the idea that it doesn't actually matter where the symptoms are coming from, let's just get an inventory of the symptoms and give you something for them. How could it be that you can have psychiatrists who have hundreds and hundreds of people on a parallel? How do you know people if they're that many hundreds of people and you have 15-minute appointments with them? I mean, what that looks like is you come into my office. I don't know you. Even if I'm a good doctor, I can't know you. I can't know all these thousands of people. And then I can't get to know you and what's going on inside of you. All people are doing then is symptom inventory. Oh, wait, your mood is lower. Let's give you an antidepressant, right? You're not sleeping. Let's give you sleeping medicine. Instead of saying, why is your mood lower? Let's understand you. Right? Human time costs more than medicines. There's a reason that we use roughly 4 to 5 times as much medicine as, say, the Dutch. There's a culture of greater responsibility there, greater responsibility for yourself. You come in and you say, I'm 30 pounds overweight. My cholesterol is high. My blood pressure is high. You know what happens in America? An overworked physician who's like, I got to treat all this, because here's your prescription for depression. Here's a prescription for cholesterol. Here's a prescription for blood pressure. Whereas in other systems where they're looking more at the people, the thought is, here's what you need to do, right? And then often there's support mechanisms. You have to eat better. You have to exercise. But we're not going to fix it with the medicine, because if you fix it with the medicine, the person, then you don't fix the problem and the problem is still there. Right? The medicine maybe helps the cholesterol come down, but they're still not taking care of themselves. Then it goes back up anyway. I mean, it's predictable, right? But we don't look. We're so short-sighted. And that's so true in terms of mental health. Like, we don't want to invest, for example, time, health systems in the therapy for people, because it costs money to go see the therapist. So then, well, you can see a therapist through the health plan. Yeah, there's nobody on the panel that has openings, right? It takes 2 months to find a person, but then you find a person, you're authorized X number of sessions. You know why? Because it's all cost savings. But then the person's going into the ER, right? Or the, or it's even in the hospital once. Okay, you saved by being short-sighted. You saved $3,000-$4,000, didn't send in the therapy, right? That one ER visit cost $20,000, right? But so even if we don't look at humans, because like the humans matter, right? But if we just thought about money and got the health systems, can you just think about money, the thing that you're concerned with, but don't think of it this far out? The health systems would take better care of people, but the systems don't do that. People don't stay with the systems a long time. The employers are paying for health care and employees don't stay forever now. But really, it's just the same pool of people, right? From one job to another, or one insurer to another, and no one's paying attention to the long term. Then we start sounding a lot like there's an Idiocracy, a movie, right? Where there's healthcare where the person's like on a conveyor, right? And they just go and say things at the other end, they get a medicine. You know, that movie was made as a parody a while ago. We're a lot closer to that than one might think. I mean, oftentimes that's a person's effective experience. No one says get on the conveyor belt, say a bunch of things. By the time you're off it in 10 minutes, there'll be a bunch of pills in your hand. But that's kind of what's happening.
Yeah. Dr. Conti, I want to be respectful of your time and give you the final word. And maybe we could leave for people out there who are resistant to the idea of even taking a sounding of the depth of their own mental health, or people who don't know if they even need to look underneath the hood. Perhaps you could leave the audience with just your broad advice on creating an approach to something, in my mind at least, mental health, that will lead to a much more fulfilling and enriching life. You have to go through the work and do the work, obviously, but just your thoughts on where people can start. Maybe they're not even sure whether or not they need it.
Right. So there are just a couple of questions to answer. And here, what I'm trying to do is really reduce to simplicity. So there are questions we can ask ourselves. Like, am I happy with my life? Most people have a yes or no answer. Well, if they have a no answer, there's something making them unhappy. It's not that everything makes them unhappy. So then you look at, okay, if your answer is no, or you're like, some things are good, some things are not, what are those things? And it's like, let's take stock of what they are. Let's ask questions. Is there anything I'm hiding from myself? It's remarkable how the answer to that is very, very often yes. Is there anything going on over and over in my mind that I'm not paying attention to? Are there things going really, really well in my life that I want more of? Are there things that are really weighing on me? These are simple questions we can ask ourselves. But here's the key. Ask yourself with curiosity, not with judgment. Or ask someone who will be curious with you. Like sometimes the answer could be even clergy, because the thought is someone who's non-judgmental. Not that the clergy is supposed to be professional help, but someone can go and say, hey, here's this thing going on inside me, not feel fear being shamed. Sometimes it's not that, but you know what I mean? Just with a sense of openness, like, oh, if there's something running over and over again in my head, or I'm my 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever it may be, and you know, this thing from when I was a kid really comes to the surface every time I see X, you know, news that someone was in a car accident, because it was a car accident back then, or something like that. Like, let me just pay attention to that without the reflexive shame that leads us to hide it, which is why this compassionate curiosity, that's really the answer. It's really two words. Have compassionate curiosity for yourself. That's really the answer. There are a lot of different ways to do that, but part of having compassionate curiosity is accepting our humanness. So we can all be overwhelmed. You know, no one is stronger than the forces around us. And like, that's just true in human. And if we look at ourselves, we don't, I say a lot, don't make yourself special in a bad way, right? In a negative way. Most people who think X isn't okay for me, it is not okay for me to feel this way. It's not okay for me to have depression after that loss, or it's not okay to me have intrusive thoughts about something I saw in the job, whatever the job may be. But if it were someone else, that person would understand. Would say, oh, I understand. Look at what you've been through. You need to talk about that. But not me. Like, I'm special in the way that I'm supposed to be better than that. No, it's not. That's, you know, that is making the self special in a way that is not good. We are all human. Extend yourself the same human courtesy you would other people, and then you can be compassionately curious about yourself. And wherever that may lead, you're off to the races.
I love it. Easier said than done. I'm definitely guilty of giving people more grace than I am giving myself that grace. That's a tough one that I have bounced up against many times.
Yeah, it's all this, the things that are easier said than done are still doable, right? But that's yes. where the work comes in, because it is easy yeah. to say it, but the doing is different. But that's where the work of it is. Right? But we've got to start with the ability to say it, right? To see what is that work, and then to start trying it. If people start treading in this ground and it's evoking a lot of shame, there's something to look at from that, right? But just being okay with whatever comes up in ourselves, giving us that freedom. I can at least think whatever comes into my head. Like, I can acknowledge that I'm thinking or feeling whatever is going on inside of me. That's often the start. And instead, even that's easier said than done. So let's give people the guidance to get to the starting line and help to get, you know, to become off to the races. That's how we do the harder part, which is the doing of it.
I couldn't agree more. Dr. Conte, thank you so much for your time. And I really appreciate what you do professionally as well. I think it made such an immense impact in people's lives. And I hope that people listening to this can take the first step, which I found to be, for myself, the hardest one. You know, after that, it was actually quite easy.
Yes. Yes. That's right. Take that first step. That's a wonderful message to end on. Absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I hope that it got you thinking. And more importantly, I hope that it gets you talking. And if you don't want to talk to somebody, or you feel like you don't have anything to talk about, never be afraid to reach out to those that you love and care about, because we never know what somebody is dealing with quietly. If you want to learn more about the world and work of Dr. Paul Conte, please check out drpaulconte.com. Link is down in the show notes. Thank you again for listening to Change Agents, an Ironclad original presented by Montana Knife Company, and we will be back next week.